Welcome to the IT Babble podcast, where we talk about educational technology and a whole lot more. You can find our podcast on iTunes, please subscribe, or your very favorite podcasting app. Also, you can find our blog at www.itbabble.com. Welcome back, everybody. It is the IT Babble podcast. It has been quite some time since you've had the joy of listening to Tony and I. Tony, what have you been up to? And we've been posting on the blog, so definitely read us at itbabble.com. But Tony, what have you been up to since we've last podcast?
Nothing, Patrick. I've done absolutely nothing. I've just been waiting for this podcast in a mostly meditative state. We've been working on paperwork and processes to apply for educational technology grant, which I believe that we have secured, which is great. And I've been going through the process with the vendors to do the bidding and making all the plans for next year. We're going to be updating some classrooms and switching one entire campus over to Apple so that's a little bit more streamlined.
Big projects. Big projects. Oh man. We've been pretty busy here. I wrote a post about it. I think it published on Monday. We were looking at revamping and modernizing our classroom's AV systems. Because in the past we had like a VGA document camera and we had RCA DVD players or VCR players. And then we have HDMI Apple TV. So we needed something that could handle all those different types of inputs. And we were using, like just a receiver, like an audio visual receiver, something you would put in your, if you have like a big stereo system at home, like that type of receiver. But now that we are all HDMI, our document cameras HDMI, Apple TV, of course, is HDMI, our projectors take HDMI, everything we use is HDMI. This has allowed us to really simplify that system, and we can start replacing these receivers, which fail at an alarming rate. And they're expensive to replace. They're like $250, $350. So we're able to remove those from the classroom and simplify it with an HDMI switch, which is anywhere between $30 and $60. An amplifier, because we have like some inexpensive Sony bookshelf speakers mounted to the wall, using an amplifier to power the sound for that and keep that up in the ceiling. And with all the cables and everything, we can do it for under $200 per classroom. And we were looking at other solutions that were going to be several thousand dollars, or, you know, streamlining and getting everybody the same type of receiver. And that would have been, you know, hundreds of dollars per classroom, $500, $700 per classroom. So I think this solution is affordable, it's reliable, and most of all, it's something that we can work on and have replacements at the ready in case things fail, because everything fails eventually. So that's what we've been working on.
Yeah, I saw your diagram. I like it. I think it's pretty streamlined. And one of the issues that I've been having is my school I'm at now, before I joined, they contracted out about six rooms to a company to develop a new type of classroom. And I'll be honest, they were experiments. Like, they're working on a new kind of standard classroom. So they came up with a few models and they implemented them. And that's cool. And the teachers opted into that. So these are the kind of people that want to, you know, experiment and see what's happening. But the basic rule here is that the more things you buy, the more problems you're going to have. So when I looked at your outline, I'm like, okay, this is basically as streamlined as you can get to accomplish what you want. And what I mean by the more things you buy, the more problems you're going to have is this. Let's say I have a projector and a screen in my classroom, and I have my laptop, and I want to connect the laptop to both of those. Well, if I have to have a device that connects the projector to a screen, that's another device in the middle. And that means that device one day can go bad and nullify one or both screens. If I have to have two devices, one on the projector and one on the screen, to make them talk to each other, now I have this two screens and two other devices. So now that's four things So now I have four things that can break instead of two or three. So everything that you add in the chain creates a future maintenance issue. And what a lot of schools don't seem to do, and I've noticed this very specifically in the United States. So I did quite a few school visits a couple of years ago. And I noticed that the schools, especially the private schools, they raise money for something and they build it, and it's phenomenal. But within the fundraising component, there isn't a reserve set up for repairs in 5 years, 6 years, or 7 years. So then the repairs have to come out of the operational budget. And that operational budget wasn't able to support this project initially because there wasn't enough money in the operational budget. So they didn't have enough money to build it, so they raised money to build it, but now they don't have enough money to take care of it. And I've seen that in multiple places, and I'm not singling anything out. I just think that it's kind of a artifact or a symptom or a problem created from fundraising to build things. So the message is, like, let's say that you need $100,000 and you fundraise it to build a space. Well, in about 5 to 7 years from the time you open that space, you're going to need roughly $10,000 to $15,000, about 10% of the investment, in order to keep it up to date and repaired. So if you could just set that up as part of the process, I think it makes it a lot easier. And that money needs to be banked. It can't be spent on other things. It can't be used to pick up other shortfalls. Mm-hmm. Now, let's say that you have, you know, you're off your budget a little bit, and you end up with $8,500 instead of $10,000. It's probably going to be fine. But you need to have that goal, I would say, of at least 10% of whatever you're fundraising needs to be achievable. You need to have that much money available 5 to 7 years from the day that you start the project. And you're going to have to, I mean, Patrick, you know, like, you could be using a company's equipment that requires firmware. That company could go out of business.
Yep.
So now, usually a third party will come along and find a way to retrofit it, take it over, and it's not as expensive as a new one, and you can keep using it for a while. Or you're going to have to replace one big item because the firmware is no longer supported, or there's some kind of standard that it doesn't meet anymore. This is the kind of stuff that people don't really think about. And I think a long time ago, it wasn't like that. Companies built things to last. But now, I feel like a lot of these companies just build things for now, and they don't really think about if it's going to work in 7 years. Now, they'll tell you, oh, it's durable, it's going to work, but they don't know.
Yeah.
Especially if it's a new product, how have they tested it?
Yeah, that was when we switched over to laser projectors. That was one of my, because laser projectors were, these are all brand new products that are at this new price point, which we could afford. And before, they were twice as expensive, maybe even three times as expensive. So they weren't even considered, but here they are. And one of my concerns was, like, well, this is brand new. Like, what can you tell me? And luckily, another school had put them in a year ago. And in fact, it was a university here in Indianapolis. And they said, look, we put this in a year ago. This professor has not turned off his laser projector, the exact same model we would put in your classrooms, for the entire year. Like, it's been on 24/7. 365 days, and it's still, they just refuse to turn it off. Like, nobody, so right. They just keep it on. And they said, it's working fine. And I was like, okay. And I did some math, and I was like, okay, that would be like 3 or 4 years of us using it, because our teachers do turn that stuff off at the end of the day and are pretty good. But you're right. You got to build in these things, or you're going to end up with very expensive door stoppers, or spaces that are partially usable. And because they're partially usable, teachers aren't going to want to use them. I know exactly what you're talking about. There was a nice space here at our school that was built for our middle school, a middle school commons. And just this year, there was like a big AV panel where you could plug in a microphone, or you could plug in like your computer with an audio jack, so you could play through the speakers in that room. Well, all the sound was like turned way, way down. Way down. When you try to turn it up, it would distort the sound. And so we actually had to call the people out who did the room to kind of come and service it. And they're like, yeah, we don't know what happened, but yeah, all your sound levels are pushed way, way down. So
yeah,
we're just going to come and pump it up. And wow, this connection doesn't work. So we're going to resolder these connections on. And yeah, it was just like maintenance, basic maintenance, just wear and tear on the room that needed to be fixed and updated. And yeah. And, so far that wasn't terribly expensive, but I mean, eventually there are things in that room that are going to have to be replaced. Speakers, projectors. I mean, yeah. So it's good to have that money banked away, so you know you have it when you need it.
A long time ago, like in 2009, I think, or 2010, I went to a very, very well-to-do school in Hong Kong, and I was touring around with their IT people. And in their classrooms, they had like a nice metal panel on the wall with all the different kinds of connections.
Yeah.
And these were all like VGA. And I was speaking to them and I was like, okay, so the next standard, you know, coming out is, you know, there's DVI, there's HDMI is coming after that. How do you update these panels? You know, like,
oh yeah.
And they're like, well, we can't. like, what?
Yeah.
Like, we can't really update the panel. Like, we have to take the panel out, patch it, put in a new panel, and rewire everything.
Yeah.
So, and this school is huge. It's huge. And I'm just sitting there like, man, they're never, ever going to go to the next standard until the old standard is completely unsupportable.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they just won't, you know, they might start saving money for it, but they're never going to do it.
Yeah.
Because it's not just about the money either. It's about how much time you have to do the work.
It is indeed. And can you do the work? So if you have a, let's say you have a Crestron system, and Crestron is, I mentioned them in my post, and they're great. Their hardware is rock solid, but I am not allowed to work on any Crestron systems because I'm not Crestron certified. And you don't just become Crestron certified. You have to work for a Crestron dealer to be Crestron certified. If, for example, and they make a program for those rooms, so you can program the rooms. We can have a backup of the program, but we can't access it to make any changes. So
right.
Even if they have to put in a brand new component, let's say a component fails, I mean, I could take the old component out. I could put the new component in. I could plug it in. I can hook it all up. I can turn it on, but I can't configure it to work with our system. I have to call in an expert. So, and that of course costs, you know, money, like $150, $200 just to walk through the door probably. So
yeah. An expert is a relative term.
This is like, true. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I got one more thing before we get into our talk here, Tony. I'm a big fan of Little Sis. And if you don't know what Little Sis is out there, it's an online service made by Amplified IT, a small technology group. And Little Sis will allow you to manage your school's Google Classrooms. So you can add students, you can take students away, you can bulk add students to classes, so on and so forth, add teachers, take away teachers, drop in on classes, and just see what's going on. All that good stuff was purchased. It was publicly announced yesterday on March 16th. The purchase by CDW, which is a big, if you're looking to buy technology, CDW may be a place that you, CDW.com may be a place where you go. But
well, Patrick, I'm going to tell you a little quick story about CDW.
All right.
But don't let me forget, I have a little sis question for you.
Okay.
Somebody asked me something the other day, and I've been trying to find a solution. Okay, so apparently my school is blacklisted from CDW.
Oh, wow.
So a couple of years ago, there was a MATLAB, and I've stopped this, but the school was ordering Chromebooks, and this was before COVID, but they were ordering Chromebooks like in May. And as you know, there are no Chromebooks available by May because school districts place these orders in like February, March for tens of thousands of Chromebooks.
Yeah.
So then if you're a small school and you just need like 100, there's just not any available, or they're super expensive.
Yes.
So What happened was the original vendor called the school and had already taken all the orders and then told the school, look, I can't meet these orders. So the school then contacted CDW and asked the guy, like, can you get 100 Chromebooks for this price? And the salesperson said that they could. And then a few days later, so no contract has been signed and no money has been exchanged yet. A few days later, the original vendor said, look, I've worked it out. I have all the Chromebooks. So the school calls CDW, the call sales guy, and they're like, look, we no longer need it. Thanks for, you know, trying to give us a quote, but we don't need it. This guy apparently got so livid that something happened to the school's account. So now when you try to log in, it says that the tax-exempt certificate has expired and you need to renew it. But we can't get anybody on email, and we could sit on phone for like 5 hours and no one ever answers. So I don't know if we're blacklisted or if CDW isn't even a real company. They're just like some kind of weird bot that buys and sells stuff. That's why I thought it was weird that they bought a service.
Yeah. I find it weird too.
So we're either blacklisted or CDW has no customer service. That's my story.
I've had a mixed experience with CDW myself. Nothing to that extent, but definitely I can having great difficulty getting a hold of our CDW rep. Trying to get a quote has been very difficult in the past from CDW, and I don't know if we're just because they're enormous. So I don't know if we're just our school is too small. We don't do enough volume of business for them to be, you know, worth the time or not. But yeah. Anyway, it worries me a little bit when a big giant company gobbles up a much smaller company, and a company that I like quite a bit. So I'll keep my eye on it. I'll update if there's a problem. All right, now we've got tons of things to talk about, Tony. We can talk about safe searches and firewall, which has kind of been a big topic you wanted to talk about. I've got a really small topic about podcasting equipment. But you want to start off with no more SAT, ACT, no more GPAs, no more grades. And what you need to do if you want to go this route is tell me about this.
Patrick, I would say, how often does this come up? Like, we've talked about this before, right? This comes up like every 5 or 10 years.
Yeah.
Right?
Instead of grades, it's standards based education.
Yeah. Something.
Yeah.
So recently on LinkedIn, these universities, now this universities, people at universities, and if I were running these universities, I would not let these people do this. They're posting and bragging, we're no longer going to look at the SAT or ACT. Now, probably that's not true. That's why I wouldn't let them post it. They may not be using it to make the final decision, but if they're signed up for the college board, if they're signed up with the college board, the student who takes the SAT can put the university's name down at the SAT test, and then that university gets the scores.
That's right.
Are they just not really going to look at it? Are they just going to be like, oh, close your eyes, another one came in? So this is something I think everybody needs to know, and I don't know if all this is true, but conversations ensue, and people are asking these university reps, okay, well, if you're not going to use the SAT or ACT, that's great. What's your plan? And Patrick, I can tell you, they don't really seem to understand GPAs or how they're calculated. And it's very clear that they don't understand that different schools calculate their GPAs differently. So I threw out a couple of examples to this one person. And I let them, I kind of like let them think about the different problems related to taking only one number from a school and not checking it against something else. And the story I told them was about when I had a couple of years ago, I did a grade analysis, some data analysis for a school, and they paid me to do this. So I had 10 years worth of high school grades, and I used Excel plus Amazon's like QuickSight tool to run different types of graphs on the grades and to do different kinds of math on the grades. And this is what I found. because of the way they had set up their grade scale and the points that different courses gave to different grades, you are better off at that school taking honors courses and getting a C than taking the normal course and getting a B or B plus. And the content of the normal course and the honors course was the same. They just had a higher expectation for the work the students would do in the honors course. So it was to your benefit as a student, to your GPA, to take an honors course because it looked better on your transcript and your GPA would come out higher if you did less work. So in that situation, these students, the only thing they have really to motivate them is to know that they have to take an SAT or ACT, and a university is going to check the courses that you took, your GPA, letters that you might have, like of reference, and they're going to look at your standardized tests to get a full picture of your high school. And I think that's what's missing. And then I also mentioned to this person that a pure IB school might throw out traditional grades and just give students ones to sevens. So in the school, like for biology, IB, like bio or whatever, you're going to get like a five. Well, what does a five mean? Because the IB tells you that a five is equivalent to a certain grade or percentage every year, and that slides. So 1 year, a five might be equivalent to a B minus. And the next year, a five might be equivalent to an A minus. And the next year, a five could be equivalent to a C plus. And that changes every single cycle based on the number of students who take it and the grades all the students are generating worldwide. So how are you going to align for IB schools and maybe other types of curricula that are similar to the IB? How are you going to just convert to GPA? And how are you going to know year to year that a GPA from one school is the same the next year for that same school? And I mentioned also when I sent this very long comment to this person that there are at least six common ways to calculate GPA. And are they going to be telling schools they have to do it in one particular way for any applications that come to that school? So now what you're saying is, let's say there's 100 universities who will take the SAT and SAT and one that won't, and that one requires you to write a different grade scale calculation and GPA calculation for applications and make a separate transcript just for that school. Like, people aren't really thinking this all the way through. Now, I'm not being critical of the concept. I'm just saying that if they want to do it, they have to really think beyond just saying we're going to take GPAs. Okay, I'm done.
Yeah. Okay. Nice. Nice. Yeah. It's so much work to make that shift. It's not just a decision that a small group of people make in a summer, and then all of a sudden it's there. There's a lot of moving parts that I think a lot of people don't consider, like you're pointing out. That's good. That's good.
Yep, and I am for hire, Patrick. For anybody who wants to do this, just reach out to me and I can make your dreams come true. I can give
Absolutely.
you a way to take basically any number from any high school and make it a good number without overly manipulating it and causing some kind of catastrophic problem.
So
So just reach out to me.
Lori Loughlin is not going to be calling you for help. I don't think.
Oh, that's a low blow, Patrick.
But well, let's move on to our biggest topic of the show is safe search, firewall, etc. That kind of safe surfing, safe searching. Because this comes up a lot. I get asked this question. I'm sure you do too. About how, if you're a one-to-one program, how do you keep students? How do you monitor students when they're not on campus? How do you content filter when they're not on campus, or when they are on campus? Oh, like th this is a question that we get from new parents, from existing parents, from prospective employees, people looking for employment here. So we get this question quite a bit, and I think every school does it a little differently if they do it at all. But yeah, let's talk about this because you've got it broken down into on campus and off campus. So I guess we'll start with on campus. Let's go there. What do you do? Like what devices, I guess, are you monitoring?
Okay. So I, in an ideal situation, which I'm currently not in, and this has to be remedied over the summer, but it can't be done right now. It's too disruptive. All the devices on your network need to be approved devices. So that means that every laptop has to be identified in some way. So if a student is BYOD and they're bringing their own laptop, you need to have a simple registration process where you collect the MAC address at least of the laptop at a minimum. So you'll have like a spreadsheet that'll have the student's name, email, and the MAC address of their laptop. And that's important. If you have time, you can install a client on the laptop. Like Umbrella has a client, Jump Cloud, which is a service I use, they have a client, and that actually collects additional metadata on the laptop. So it's basically impossible for the student to go in and like change their MAC address and get away with it. But very few people know how to do that, and it's not a huge concern.
Yeah.
So you need to be able to know who's on your network. Now, you should already have collected this information somehow from your teachers and for any devices that the school owns. But if you haven't, the main thing is when you get a teacher laptop in, you need to make sure the laptops have a naming pattern. Like if I give Patrick a laptop, it might be PC for his first two initials and then laptop 103. And so in the asset management where you have a list of laptops, it would say PC and then laptop 103, you know, that's Patrick's laptop. Mm-hmm. And that name will show up like on the network. It'll show up in Meraki. It'll show up in different places. So if there's a problem, you basically know where the problem's coming from. I mean, if you use services like Malwarebytes, which are installed on the user's laptop, Malwarebytes will tell you the name of the computer. So you can say PC 103 has malware, is causing a problem. We know that's Patrick's laptop. If you hand out laptops and you've assigned them just a number, and then you've gone into like a database, like an asset database, and you kind of type the person's name in, that's okay unless you actually need to act quickly. This is what I'm kind of facing now, where the assets were tracked properly. They've been given an asset tag. The tag is in a database. The user's name is in the database. But if I go to Malwarebytes and Meraki, I don't see the person's name or initials. I just see the asset number. So I have to look up each one in a separate system to figure out what's going on, and that takes time. So basically, you want to try to make some encode it. Like, I don't want to say the name of Patrick's Apple is Patrick Colley's laptop, because then when Patrick goes to an internet cafe or something, everybody can see who he is.
Yeah.
But I do want to come up with a naming system that gives the IT department a quick way to know if it's a teacher, if it's a student, and who it is, where it is. So that's just stuff you have to think through. So you got to name all your stuff and internally need to be able to know who's using what. And then, yes, we run like Cisco Umbrella for our DNS, and we do all the core filtering there that filters teachers and students. We don't do things like completely unfilter teachers, because a teacher can click on something and make a mistake lose their job. So we don't do that. And if something needs to be unblocked, it is very easy to unblock it. And we have very few requests for unblocking. For Chromebooks, we are running Go Guardian per your recommendation, Patrick.
Yep.
And that's working well. Now, so that's kind of the internal stuff. And you have like a six-gen firewall. We're actually upgrading our firewall soon to have a little bit more power, and then the firewall is like an extra layer. So if Umbrella misses it, maybe the firewall will stop it. But the firewall is designed to really stop things from coming in from the outside.
The malware, that's kind of the main viruses,
like
attacks,
or just people attacks, right? So it's I don't think firewall filtering is very good usually, but this new one could be, but I don't know.
Yeah.
Now for off campus, it's been weird with COVID. I'm not a big proponent of monitoring kids off campus, but with kids going to school at home, there's been a bigger push. So we kind of went back and forth. The main issue is if the students own the equipment, they have administrative rights, anything you put on the computer, they can figure out a way to get around.
Yeah.
So a few weeks ago, I made some videos to send to parents. Video number one shows the parents how to access their home network and set up parental restrictions on their actual home network.
Yep.
So we've been pushing that lately for parents who are concerned. And with the message that, you know, if your kid has a phone, we're not managing their phone. So sure, they're not going to get on their Chromebook, but they're going to get on their phone. So if you really want to manage what they can see, you need to add the content management. Most of the providers in this area will come out to homes and help families do that as part of a service.
Yep.
But we sent basic instructions home. And then for the Chromebooks, the kids, they buy the Chromebooks, they own them. I don't really want to put the enterprise license on it. GoGuardian plus the Chrome and devices management within Google take care of almost all the problems, but the one thing that they can't do is turn off the guest mode. So we figured out that if a parent is the first one to sign into the Chromebook, they actually can make an account, turn off the guest mode, and then the student can make a full account, not a guest account, and use it. And the GoGuardian goes onto their account, but on the parent's account, but the guest access is disabled. So if the parent ever wants to log into the Chromebook, they can log in, they can reset the Chromebook, they can do whatever. So we made instructions for that as well, just to give parents the option. Like, you actually can have an account. All you need is a Gmail. They do need a Gmail. And then you can have an account that helps you co-manage this device because you own it.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what we're doing now.
A lot of people don't know that. I'm just going to, about the Chromebook, the first person who logs in is considered the admin of that Chromebook.
Right.
And I think we had a parent who actually emailed, and they're like, we're trying to do this, but our child signed in first for distance learning, but now we're trying to do this and it won't let us because all of a sudden the school, because we use GoGuardian to manage that account anyway. So yeah, they ran into some problems. So, but that's good. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Keep going. Sorry.
That's kind of where we're at. And I think next year, my plan is the first year the students are in the BYOD program with Apple and Windows computers, I'm going to be putting the umbrella client on those machines.
Excellent. Yeah.
And then I'll pull it off going into their second year just because I don't want to like pay for additional licenses. And that'll kind of bridge that gap. Because in our grade 8, the kids are allowed to switch during grade 8 from Chromebooks to Windows and Mac. So, and I didn't design this, but I've kind of inherited it, and I can't really get off of it for another year or two. So what I'm thinking is grade 8 kids who are in that first group who've ditched their Chromebook because they think they want absolute freedom are not going to get absolute freedom. They're going to get a little bit, but the umbrella is going to still be on there so that we can monitor a bit more of what they're doing. And mostly it's not the monitoring. The umbrella client just maintains the website blocking when the kids are off campus.
Well, that, yeah. And so yeah, I've read a couple blog posts out there who don't like schools monitoring students at all. Now, they're coming more from the higher education. And I don't know if universities monitor students the way that high school and middle school and lower and elementary school does, but they don't like it. But for us, we get something called E-rate money. I don't know if you are familiar with E-rate. I'm sure you are, Tony, but I don't know if our listeners are. But E-rate is a federal program where any school, public or private, and even libraries can apply for it, and it offsets some of the cost of your internet. So, and it can be pretty significant depending on the needs of the school. But in order to be E-rate compliant, you must be compliant to the Children's Online Privacy Protection Rule, or COPPA. And if your school, and in order to do that, you must have some sort of content filtering and monitoring going on your network, or you are technically not compliant and you could not get that money or have to give that money back. So just a little something out there. Just throwing it in. So, but that's good. I like the idea of umbrella, though. And umbrella doesn't care if it's Mac, Windows, Chromebook, iPad. Android tablet, it doesn't seem to care. It just will work. Is that correct, Tony?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. And you said that the licenses are fairly priced. Maybe I guess that's a good way of doing it because it's Cisco. So
for Umbrella?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think so. So there's a free tier, which is just like some free DNS filtering, and it's good. But if you want to install the client, you do have to pay, but they have an educational fee. I feel like it's $8 a year. Okay. It's not very much.
That's good.
I'll have to look. It's not too much. And then they have a second tier for the DNS too. So like you can have basic filtering, you can have more intense customization, and you can have the client.
Mm.
And you buy the client licenses, and they're easy to install. And then again, it's not like I don't really use Umbrella to monitor students. I just set the filtering, and then I log in once a week, and it has an app discovery system. So it shows you all the new websites and apps that people are using, and you can check them to see if any of them need to be blocked or if they can just be left alone.
Oh, that is so sweet. That's awesome. That's awesome.
Yeah, so I would say it's very passive. And the resolution that you get is really just based off the name of the laptop. So I'm not necessarily seeing, like, it's not like GoGuardian where you're seeing all the searches and all of that. So you can see the websites that a laptop has visited, but not really much more than that. And it's a lot of data. I mean, it's almost too much data to look at unless you really need to do a deep dive. Yeah. And somebody's like, you've got to search. Like the dashboard isn't really going to show you anything. But the app dashboard is nice. And that comes from within the school when people search, because the Umbrella is collecting information as people use the internet, and it's collecting it without showing you who they are. So you don't know who's been going to Facebook. You just know how many times, like how popular it is.
Yeah.
And and that's good. And you can whitelist sites, and you can like make certain applications work very easily. You don't have to be like an engineer to do it.
Yeah.
So anyway, I think it's pretty good, and it's fast. Like the DNS is fast. It's good. It's a good service.
Yeah. Yeah. And I heard that, and you've said, cause we don't have it here, but you've said that it's very difficult, for people to bypass. Like they can't really bypass it.
It's hard. And you can set up your firewall so that if somebody changes their DNS, they're not allowed out through to the internet. So like you can tell your firewall, if they're not using Umbrella DNS, they don't get any internet. They just shut down.
Nice. Oh, wow.
So if they want to run a VPN or something on your campus, it's going to change the DNS, and then they can't even get out. So it's pretty good, like, in that way. And I think you can do that with the free version of Umbrella plus a new, like a current generation firewall. Now you do have to have a newer firewall. Like an older one's probably not going to work.
Yeah. Yeah. And those things are expensive. So if you're out there looking at a Meraki firewall or, I don't know, I guess you could use a Dell SonicWall.
Okay. So interesting. And I normally don't, well, I don't like promoting people because somebody might get mad, but Rhino Networks resells like Cisco and a lot of other stuff. And so does SHI. They're a big vendor.
Yep.
Like, they have educational pricing for Cisco firewalls. So the current generation of just the Cisco firewall, not the Meraki. If you have somebody who can configure it like you have to configure it, but you can just buy the hardware at an educational price from those two vendors, and it's usually 50 to 60% off. So that firewall for about $6,000, you can get for about three.
That's awesome.
And you do have to configure it on your own. There's no technical support. But if you have somebody who can configure, anybody who configured a Cisco firewall 5 years ago can do this one. It's just the next generation of the normal Cisco firewall.
And I'll point out that Cisco is enormous. So no matter where you are in the world, you can probably find a vendor to help you out with this. I mean, obviously you'd have to pay them, but it'll probably be a lot cheaper buying it on your own than going through the vendor to purchase it.
But it does not have the sweet interface of Meraki or ForcePoint or any of these super expensive ones. And it's not in the cloud. I mean, this is just hardware. But it has these features that I'm talking about, these kind of next level filtering features. And, you know, you have to use this DNS to get to the internet. It has all that built in. And it's fast. It's fast. So that's something, you know, if you're working somewhere and you've got a good engineer on site, you don't need a software as a service pseudo piece of hardware like Meraki or ForcePoint. Just go with the newest generation Cisco firewall. Like I said, Rhino Networks and SHI are vendors that can get you educational prices.
Yep. Yeah, excellent. And I've worked with SHI. They're pretty good. They're like CDW, but I don't think they're quite as big, and they are a little faster to respond. So anyway, we're on to our last topic, Tony. Oh man.
Uh-oh.
It's all about podcasting. I love it. So Zoom came out, and I'm not talking about Zoom like Zoom video conferencing. I'm talking about Zoom, the handy recorders, those kinds of things. And they're great products. They are just fantastic. They have come out with some new products last, in August of 2020. So right at the beginning of the school year, which is a perfect time to come up with one. And so first we're recording right now on a Zoom H6, which is a handy recorder with 4 XLR inputs. And individual gain controls for each one. It's phenomenal. And it is a little pricey. I think the H6 is now down to $320, but they came out with a Zoom H8. A Zoom H8, Tony.
I know, Patrick. I bought it.
You bought the Zoom H8? No, you bought the PodTrack P8.
I bought the PodTrack.
Yeah, so okay. The H8 is like this, but instead of having 4 XLR, it has 6 plus microphone module at the top. You can record up to, I think, 8 tracks on it or 12 tracks on it. Anyway, it's fantastic. It's like $300. It's like $400. But they came up with Zoom PodTrack, the P4 with 4 XLR inputs and the P8 with 8 XLR inputs. Plus, anyway, they're phenomenal. And you have the Zoom PodTrack, Tony.
Yes. So my school wanted to launch a podcast, and we had a budget for it. And I was like, you know, this is going to, we already had some of the equipment. So I'm like, I'm going to get this thing and see how it works. And it's pretty amazing. Now, here's a few things. First off, I do think the hardest part about using any of this is incorporating like a Google Meet or Zoom call, like a Zoom software call, into the podcast, which is what we're doing.
Yep.
And here's the tough part. Everything's easy to set up. The sound quality out of the box is amazing. It's easy to adjust. The recording's great, straight to SD. We're doing SD on the machine, and then we offload it. But and it's smart. Like, it's really smart. Like, when you do a Zoom call or Google Meet, it creates different tracks, right? It's a multi-track recorder. So let's say I've got 3 people in the room and 1 person on Google Meet calling in. When you get the recordings done, the Google Meet recording is on its own track, but it is in stereo and it is a much bigger and broader waveform.
Oh, okay.
Whereas the individual tracks are, they're quasi stereo, but when you import them, they're just one channel. So like, if you import them in the Audacity or GarageBand, each of the people talking in the room is one channel. But when you import the sound that's from the Google Meet or the Zoom call, it's two stereo channels, and the waveform is very robust. So you do have to, your options are to, like, during the recording, to kind of beef everybody up and then also manipulate their headphones so they don't sound too loud to one another. which is a little tough to do. Like, or when you in your audio editing, you bring everybody in. What I did, here's my trick. I created a stereo channel for each of the people, mm-hmm. and I just pasted their audio in twice. And that actually creates like the feeling that they're sounding as robust and as full as the digital recording from like the Zoom call or the.
So when you paste it in twice, do you phase like one channel like to the left and one channel to the right? Or do you leave them both like centered or?
I leave them both centered, and it's basically a trick. It's an effect. It's a trick. And if you do it, you'll see what I mean.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. And there are tutorials out there on YouTube. You can find this on YouTube. There's a bunch of them out there on to do exactly what you're, because that's how I learned how to do it.
But this is what messes you up with this thing, okay? You can't think about how it works or your brain will melt. Because I started, after we did the recording, I was at home and I was like, did that actually record? Like, there's no way this actually worked. And this is why. Somehow the Zoom Podtrac, it knows that the people on the Google Meet who are being mixed from the mixer into the Google Meet are not supposed to be recorded with the Google Meet. It only records the person who's not in the room.
How interesting. That's pretty cool. That's awesome.
And it's doing it all on one cable.
Oh yeah.
So somehow, I guess with like frequencies or something, somehow it knows that the three people who are in the room who are also part of the Google Meet, because they're, when you connect to the Google Meet, the audio for the Google Meet is coming from the Podtrac. So these three people have been mixed into the Google Meet. The Google Meet's output is back to the Podtrac. So it's input Podtrac and output Podtrac on the Google Meet or the Zoom. But somehow the Podtrac knows the only person it should record on the multi-channel for the Google Meet or the Zoom is the guest. If you start thinking about that, you're like, oh. I've ruined my podcast. There's no way this is possible.
Now,
there's no way.
Tony, you're going to scare people. Stop scaring people, Tony.
I was sitting in my chair at home. I'd worked out. It was the end of the day. I knew I had to edit the podcast the next day. And I was like, oh my God. It's so hard to get these guests too. These guests are getting. I'm like, oh my God, I bet we did this all wrong. Doesn't make any sense. And I'm like, but you tested it. You tested it with the Google Meet. You tested it before. You had people call in. There's no way it worked. And so I pulled the files up. Like, I freaked out. I found all the files. I had them in the Google Drive, pulled them all up, and it worked. I was like, okay, don't think about it. Just don't think about how it works, because Zoom doesn't want you to know.
They don't. There is not a lot of products like this out there on the market, like the Podtrac. So Rode has one that's it's called the Rodecaster Pro. It's $600. And it gives you kind of what the P8 gives you. But the P8, I think, has a lot more features to it. And it is $500, $100 cheaper for more features. But these things are super simple to work on. The Rodecaster Pro has to be plugged into power. The P8, Tony, I could be wrong, but the Podtrac, you can put batteries in it. Or you can run it off a cell phone battery charger. Is that correct?
That's correct, for a limited amount of time.
Yeah.
I haven't tried that though, because I'm using three microphones that all need the preamp.
Yeah.
So I'm definitely not going to do that with a battery. And the other thing is the Rode's files, when it's done, the files on the SD card have to be converted, whereas the Zoom's are normal WAV files.
Yep. And you can even, I know on my H6 at least, I can tell it to record on MP3 if I want to. Because WAV files, for people who don't know, MP3 is a very compressed file format, so it's much, much smaller. Whereas a WAV file, like for example, this podcast is probably going to be pretty close to a gig in size when I'm done with it. But I'm going to mix it down to an MP3 file, which will be down about 30 megabytes. So the compression is pretty severe, but Rode, wow, it's probably uncompressed, a type of uncompressed file, maybe even proprietary.
Yeah, and I think it's, you know, designed for sound quality, and it could be even better, like if you're a professional engineer, I don't know.
Yeah.
But I know that I just want to, like, as soon as we're done recording, I go to the pod track, I hit the SD card button, I hit the connection button, it shows up as an external drive on the Apple computer, and I just drag the files over.
That's awesome.
So that's pretty freaking simple.
That's
I actually
incredible.
don't I don't want to be doing this with this group of people. I'm teaching them how to do it. So I chose this because I thought it had the best features and that they could learn it pretty easily. And they all like it.
And for people out there like $600, $500, I don't have that money, but the PodTrack P4, which has four XLR inputs, so you can plug in four microphones into it, that comes in at $200. And it has almost all the same features as the P8. It's just smaller and more. But what I really love is that I can't do this on my H6, is that every channel you plug a microphone into, there is a headphone out. So they can hear themselves
Yes.
and everybody else, which is great because
They
they'll be
don't,
able to hear
okay. So
the Zoom call or the Google Meet.
they don't hear themselves.
Oh, they don't hear themselves.
No, so that's what I thought too. They hear the other
Oh,
person.
I thought they could hear themselves to help monitor if they're too quiet or I was, but that's okay. It's still a
You could.
fantastic for $200.
So if you're using you could do it if you're using so there's eight headphone outs. So you could use four of them to listen to other people, and you could actually have another monitor going off the other four if you
Oh,
just need four.
all right.
You could do that. But what we do is we have one person who's running the pod track. That person is monitoring everybody. So let's say one of the people on the podcast is running the pod track and part of the podcast. They actually could use like an earbud and a normal headset to do it.
Okay.
Now,
All right.
maybe we're doing something wrong, but I couldn't get them to hear themselves.
But anyway, for the people who want, if this is Zoom is a big company. There's going to be loads of videos out there to help you learn this stuff. And their instruction manual is actually very, at least the H6 I found was very easy to read and use. And yeah, it's their quality machines. My H6 has been dropped, and it is incredibly rugged. I don't know how the P4 and the P8 feel, Tony, but my H6 it feels like a tank. I mean, it's mostly just plastic with like this rubber coating on the side, but this thing is probably going to last for 15, maybe 20 years. But yeah, they're great. Zoom is a company to buy great products. So anyway. Oh, and I had one more podcasting thing, Tony. Tony, we have a new
Anchor
pod
FM.
Anchor FM. We have a new podcast. So Anchor FM is having I'm calling it experiment because this is not well thought out at all. At all. So Anchor FM will partner with WordPress.com, which is where we host IT Babble, and it will read your post and then add a computer voice to it, or you can record your own reading. You get the choice. This thing is such an afterthought. If you have an Anchor FM account, you can't add this. You have to create a brand new one, which is very
Oh,
annoying.
that's weird.
It's super weird, and you have to go to a special Anchor website in order to create this account. You can't just go to anchor.com dot FM and just create an account. That won't work. You have to go to anchor.fm/wordpress.com. Now, Tony, when I say WordPress.com, I'm not talking about the dot. You have to spell the word dot, DOT com. That took me 10 minutes. I was 10 minutes of just like very frustrated. So there are all sorts of problems. Like if you do this and you publish one, it makes a Spotify podcast for you. It puts a link to that podcast, to that episode on your WordPress.com post, which is great. So if people just want to click on that and listen to it, they can. And it sounds pretty decent, but let's say you go back and make an update to that blog post. Well, the Spotify link, there's no way for you to republish it. It won't update. At least I don't believe it does. Oh, there's, yeah, it's weird. It's definitely kind of like, hey, we're going to experiment with this, but I don't know. I don't know how long it'll be around. We'll see. I think they're just throwing spaghetti against the wall at this point, but we'll take advantage of it while we have it. So anchor.fm, really kind of neat. So that's it. That's my podcasting news, Tony. And I don't have any other topics. Do you have any other topics? Or we've gone a little long, but it has been a while since we've podcasted. So, and my mouse keeps dying. My mouse is dead. Mouse is dead.
No, I think that's enough. I've ranted enough.
Okay, done. All right. Well, it feels good to get back on the air. I will probably have this posted tomorrow morning, or Monday morning. I don't know. Sometime soon. And yeah, but anyway, for IT Babble, I'm Patrick.
And I'm Tony.
And we will catch you on the next episode. But in the meantime, check us out on itbabble.com where you can read great stuff. And we'll catch you later. So keep on babbling.